Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Thanks for joining us, as always, during these past 10 years. Today, our guest is Sarah Rudin, translator of the Gospels, published in March by Modern Library. Sarah's a leading translator of the ancient literature of the West, in a career spanning both essential Greek and Roman classics and sacred literature. Among others, she's published new translations of the Aeneid, the Confessions of Augustine, the Golden Ass, Lysistrata, and Satyricon, and many other ancient and classical works in Greek and Latin. So have you read the Gospels? Are you a Christian? That's of no matter with regard to this translation. Sarah brings the words of the New Testament alive in a manner that is both accessible and absence of pedantry. So Mark, Matthew, Luke, and we don't get to his sequel Acts, and John present not biographies, but episodes in the life of a man, a savior, and the Son of God. Jesus, who is worshiped by one third of the human beings on this planet. Sarah revives much that is lost in prior translations. Common sense, sense of humor, the nowness of the language, of the good news. Each of the authors of the Gospels present the stories of Jesus in very similar fashions, maybe not John. Yet among them, there are subtle and real differences in language and thought that are brought out in Sarah's translation to a greater degree than in others. I found myself looking at the Testaments in an almost cinematic way. And even though it might be blasphemy, I began to understand Jesus not as a personal savior, but as a person I could talk to or perish of thought, almost have a drink with. So with that quite inappropriate introduction, welcome, Sarah, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So before we begin the discussion of the work itself, and given the prolific nature of your translation of all these great works, what compels you to undertake such momentous and difficult tasks? Why do you think these tales need to be revisited in order to present them either more accurately or more accessibly to the reader?
Well, I myself am a very passionate reader, and I've just been mesmerized by books from a very, very young age. And the act of reading is so important in my own life that I have been, from very early on, really irritated by books that seem to have some purpose other than engaging a reader and making a connection between the reader and the writer over time, over space, over different cultures. And the problem with classics is just lazy translations. The lamentable difficulty is that as education became common, education in Latin and Greek became rare. So, you know, as exciting books were being written in English, translation was just considered by most people as being sort of a second best version of a classics education, you know, which was no longer essential anyway.
Right.
So I hated to think that for the majority of people, you know, who don't read Latin and Greek, a work of just ravishing beauty, such as Virgil's Aeneid, would be just about inaccessible to them. A bad, you know, boring, dull Aeneid, even though it might, you know, approximate the content of the original, is not an Aeneid. It's a betrayal of Virgil.
Well, so if we go through some of the terms that you may have altered and accurately represented, let's take, for example, one that we're all familiar with, the Son of Man. Mm-hmm. And in your notes, which are great, that seemed to be a term that you kind of wrestled with. Go through, if you will, you know, these four versions and why the Son of Man you felt was not the appropriate way to approach this person.
Uh-huh. Well, one problem is Son of Man is that it is gendered. And I don't say that, you know, in a woke a woke mood. I don't say that to be politically correct. I say that because, you know, that was simply the case from the beginning. The word that it's at stake at Greek is anthropos. which means person. And it can mean a man or a woman. It is, it simply doesn't have any gender that's important. It's grammatically masculine. And we tend to picture a masculine person when we read this literature, but just because those are the active people, those are the important people in the literature. So it's kind of a default male, but it's not a male. There's another word for a masculine male, which is aner. That's a male whose maleness is important. So that's one problem with Son of Man. It's not a man, it's a person, a human being. Another problem is that it's a portentous, high-flown kind of expression, Son of Man. That's kind of the sort of phrase that you would hear echoing from those, you know, pious Christian movies of the 1960s. You know what I mean.
Yeah, it's almost like a Marvel superhero type
movie. Yes, yeah. But this is an extremely flexible term for human being. Okay, it is the word for, it renders the Hebrew word Adam in Hebrew scripture.
Huh.
So this is, an Adam is a human being. That's the person that God created, Adam, you know, in Genesis. And it's generic term for human being. And Son of Man can refer in scripture to the Messiah. It's kind of by chance that this happens, but it does happen that the Son of Man can be the Messiah. Or son of a human being is the term in Hebrew and in Aramaic. So, you know, this Greek word anthropos is something very different and something just beautifully flexible, stylistically exciting that's exploited throughout the Gospels. It can mean human being, so it can be scientific, it can be generic, it can also be lofty in terms of referring to the Messiah, but it's also a slangy street word.
Right.
It can mean, hey, you, if you call somebody man, it's like, hey, you know, very rude. It can mean buddy. You mean pal, hey, pal, in a not nice kind of sense. And a female anthropos is a prostitute. This term can be really crude. So all this whole range, you know, is the whole possibility of wit, you know, and argumentation and developing meaning through the different registers and the ambiguity of this term, all that's exploited in the Gospels really wonderfully.
Yeah, and it's funny because you give the reader a chance to also envision the possibilities rather than saying, this is the way it was, which leads me to a question because, and you don't change this, but everyone is always told that the gospel simply means the good news. And I always wondered in my head, okay, yes, he's coming to tell us some good news, but what exactly is it? Because sometimes he tells us in a way that's pleasant and nice, and sometimes he tells you like, you idiots, or don't you understand what I'm saying? And so why did you not change it from the good news to something else?
Oh, I'm not sure I understand. You're asking?
Yeah, it's like, it is good news.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you disagree with the fact that that's the nomenclature you use. But I always have wondered in my head, since I was a little kid and started reading the different stories, the different versions by these four people, if they are indeed individual people, I always wondered about the meaning of good news, because it's such a broad term. And like your last exposition on Son of Man, it's a very broad term.
Okay, yes, it is evangelion, good news, is very broad. You know, that kind of depends on the different meanings of angelos and angelion. An angelos is a messenger, but we say wrongly in standard English translations, we say it's an angel. Okay, yeah, that's one sort of embodiment of a messenger. Angelos is messenger. So it could be a messenger from God. It could be an agent of God. It could be, you know, an agent of God with a sword. So a sort of warrior who does servant, a servant of God who does God's bidding and normally takes messages from heaven to earth. But, you know, an angelos is also an ordinary human messenger. You know, he's a guy you know, send home to say that you're going to be late for lunch. It's a, in that case, it's just a slave. You know, your factotum who goes around town doing things for you. And you open the Greek dictionary and all those registers and all those meanings are possible. And all of the possibilities are played with in the Gospels to prevent this very challenging, complex story in which people are people, recognizable, ordinary, doing very ordinary things. And they are also, you know, filled with divine, a mysterious divine purpose. And all of these levels of meaning are clashing in a very dramatic way in nearly every scene, because there's the human purposes, the human understanding, and then the mind of God presiding over this, the divine purposes. And this doesn't fit very well, but that's what makes these, you know, if you read them correctly, and I think as the authors meant them to be read, this makes the story so riveting. This provides the dramatic tension that makes this a collection of really great books in a strictly literary sense. We don't even need to go into the religious meaning. These are a literary masterpiece.
I was just thinking about when you were saying, you know, like a messenger could be someone you say, hey, go pick up my dry cleaning.
Yeah, right.
But a lot of this, I just realized a lot of the way you interpret the language, it's almost like the way I listen to the Dalai Lama. He's not preaching. He's just talking and he always throws in a joke and he's not full of himself. It's a lot of what you, I just realized, I just thought of it the first time. So I guess the question is, and some of the question doesn't go to your translations, and I apologize if it doesn't, but I could ask you a question like, and this is something I've pondered, but it really isn't a translator's job. Why do the disciples follow him so willingly? They're in their boats with their nets, and he says, come with me. And they do. But there's no explanation of why they do. And then at the end, there are those that came with him willingly and then seemingly betray him willingly. And I was thinking, okay, are you going to explain the motivations, which you really can't do because you'd have to add your own mindset. But I wonder if there's something you think about with regard to that. The ease with which they follow him and the ease in which the cock crows twice, thrice, and he's abandoned him. And he says he never would, but he does right away.
Well, you know, there are different ways that you could look at this. And it's so incredibly rich from all kinds of angles. One is the Hebrew Bible angle. So Elijah, you know, takes Elisha as a follower, and Elisha's plowing, but he you know, leaves that ordinary task instantly. The bullocks are slaughtered and off he goes. He simply leaves the family business, because it becomes instantly apparent to him that this is a divine mission. He doesn't have any choice. So you have that precedent. And so it's when the young fishermen are recruited, it's something like that. You know, they leave the boats, they leave the nets, they leave the hired men, and they walk away from it. So that's similar. You also have this, it's a very interesting, you know, generational question. So these are young men. They're probably Jesus's age, is around 30 or so, and they are married, all married. Peter, we know, is married. And, you know, yet they are continuing or resuming an education in the manner that is customary, you know, not startling for young men under the Roman Empire. So they would, if their families were fairly well-to-do, they could have something like a higher education, which means they would follow a teacher around. They would meet him, you know, likely outdoors or in some semi-sheltered place. He wouldn't, you know, hole up in some dark, musty, hot classroom, but you walk around. You'd have your classes in a public place, and these would be your followers. So this is more like, it's not necessarily culturally very different or very shocking that Jesus had these followers, his students, and literally they are students. Mathetes is the word for student. Disciple, the Latin version of that, simply means student. Yeah. So those are two ways that you can look at the recruitment. And, you know, and it's also kind of humorous as well, as when in one instance it goes pretty badly, because two guys, you know, these young men, they find out that Jesus is from Nazareth, and they're from a slightly more important town. So they start making fun of it. It's like Garrison Keillor, you know, the citizens of Lake Wobegon look down on the town of Millet nearby. So it's just this hilarious little picture of provincial life. And the pretensions, you know, that slightly wealthier or more cosmopolitan people can have.
Oh, that reminds me. And I know this is a story you've told before, because I think it's one of your favorites, but it's really good for listeners because it's the dogs versus doggies. One, it's a great story, but two, why didn't anybody else before you interpret it in that fashion? They thought it was too whatever, tell us about it.
Don't know, you know, this blows my mind. It's you know, there's nothing difficult about the word. Oh. It is a diminutive. It has the standard diminutive ending for a Greek noun. So this is a little dog. I think, well, from early on, you can kind of guess why that they didn't translate it accurately. The word doesn't exist anywhere else in scripture, and it's a fairly rare word. So certainly by the time that you have, you know, a Christian copyist and some kind of Christian institution making copies of the Gospels, he doesn't know what this word is about and why it's different from the ordinary word for dog, because his classical Greek isn't that good. He's never read Aristophanes. He hasn't seen the dirty books, you know. He hasn't seen the pagan literature, and the sort of marginal, for him, very marginal pagan literature in which this word would occur. So he knows it's some kind of dog, so he just writes dog. That's a safe way to do it. But then his version of it, you know, he's translating into Latin, or Proto-English, or some other language, you know, he interprets the Greek and he renders in another language in a very safe way. But then the text is so iconic, and it has sort of force field around it, and you don't, you know, reach in and mess with even translations of it, even when you know better. And that kind of fear and reverence have endured to this day. So certainly concerning 1,000 different passages, biblical scholars know perfectly well what the real meaning is, but they just don't dare lay their hand on it. They don't dare touch it.
Yeah, I can understand that. And there's another instance that, again, I'm making a stretch and a question to the translator. But throughout the Gospels, there is one point, and in The Last Temptation of Christ, both the book by Nikos Kazantzakis and the movie, there's this idea that he doesn't really want this job. And it's like this one instant in each Gospel where it's kind of breaking down the fourth wall. Mm. He's kind of saying, hey, I really don't want to do this. Could you kind of let me out of it and just let me go get married, have kids, that kind of thing?
All right.
And I just wonder why that's there. Why is there this one moment where he wants to shed this mantle, this heavy weight, this monkey on his back, if you will?
I think, you know, scholars would talk to you endlessly about the tensions between the historical Gospels and the religious Gospels. So the story people tell for religious purposes and the actual events behind it. And the tensions created there, I think, are just absolutely fascinating. So I look particularly at scenes which had a whole bunch of, which were very important, number one, and had a whole lot of witnesses, number two. So they were, you know, very public scenes, scenes that go on record somewhere or another, and scenes about which people can correct each other over generations. No, it happened this way. No, it happened that way. And I think that's a better source of what really historically happened. So Jesus, the whole scene in the garden and then the arrest and the trial, that's kind of the core of the historical story.
Agreed.
Because so things, and that's where it gets really, for me, moving, human, dramatic, heartbreaking, as when Peter, this sort of yutz, he's just always getting everything wrong. And I believe he was really like that, because otherwise, why depict him that way? And he draws a sword and hacks off the ear of some poor slave who's just a adjutant to one of the officials who's present. So that probably happened. Lots of people saw it. And then it's explained different ways and different, it's sort of mitigated and tamped down, explained different ways and in different gospels. But I absolutely believe it happened, because it's just the kind of dumb thing that happens. And I deeply believe that Jesus, the historical person, just didn't want to go through with this, you know, didn't really want to be, this wasn't his plan, you know, to be executed in this gruesome way that the Romans did it. Well, that's true.
And continuing along that line, you know, and you change the word when he says, my God, why have you, what I've always read as a kid is forsaken, and you change it to abandon. He's saying the same thing, you know, hey, we had a deal, you know,
right.
And what happened? And why did you change the word? Just because I'm curious.
Okay, well, I change words just for the heck of it. You know, basically, I don't need a good reason, or my good reason, I think, is that you change that word and people will read it with fresh eyes.
I agree.
You will not sort of half read it and half pay attention to it. They'll perk up and say, aha, okay, what does this actually mean? This is something that was written. This is something that I'm reading. It's supposed to reflect something that happened. What is it actually? But if they've heard it 5,000 times, you know, in the same wording, they're just not going to pay the same attention. So I don't need any reason to change it. But abandon to me was really resonant, because you have this sort of black humor theme in the Gospels about Jesus as the illegitimate or claimed Son of God. And, you know, the humor here is really horrible. I mean, in one instance, Jesus is on the cross and they're making fun of him. And it's said, you know, hey, let God, you know, come down and rescue him, take him if he wants him. And that, I'm pretty sure, refers to the Greco-Roman cultural phenomenon of infant exposure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So why would you, you know, lots and lots of babies, you know, born into marriages were exposed, you know, even if the family could afford to raise them. The only reason, though, for exposing a healthy only son would be that you think he's not yours. And the father had absolute say over this.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So I'm sure that the joke there is on this guy being the claimed son of God. But God knows this isn't his real son. You know, so like the Greek or Roman husband, out the kid goes and is abandoned. Well, so that's why I like the word abandon.
It's like, and you know,
it brings this fatherhood theme in a way that I think is kind of resonant.
Yeah. And also, like you said, I think the best explanation is like when you change a word like that, it definitely turns, yeah, you definitely focus on it because you go, oh, wait a minute, that's not the way I've always heard it. So it doesn't really make any difference why you chose it. It causes the reader to focus. That's an excellent explanation of a new translation. It's like Kafka's Metamorphosis, where sometimes they call him a cockroach, sometimes they call him a beetle, sometimes they call him vermin. Each time you think of it different, but I'm sure he's a cockroach. Be that as it may.
So yeah, forsake, you know, doesn't just, I don't think can refer to something like exposing a baby, you know. Forsake is, you walk away from another adult maybe, but child, you abandon.
Well, yeah. If you go along that, first of all, I'm Jewish. So when I was little, people who were anti-Semitic would say, before the Catholic Church changed the dogma, that the Jews killed Christ. And I had to deal with that when I was a little kid. But the issue with the Gospels for me is it makes me of two minds, because Pilate's like basically saying, I like the way you go, who the hell is this guy? Why are you bringing him here to me? Isn't this something you should take care of yourself? And then they tell him what he did, and he goes, I find no guilt in this man. This is the day I give up a prisoner. Why don't you just let him go? And then I think, well, wait a minute, maybe I was responsible.
No. This Gospels, especially the Gospel of John, are, you know, heinously anti-Semitic. And there's a pretty obvious historical reason for that, in that there was a major Jewish rebellion, and that was the cause of the Second Temple being destroyed in 70 AD. And this was sort of not the end of Jewish rebellion. You had Bar Kokhba's rebellion later on, but it was an absolutely cataclysmic defeat. The temple was destroyed, all except for what's now called the Wailing Wall. Thousands and thousands of Jews were slaughtered and enslaved. When the siege of Jerusalem broke, the bodies were already just piled up, you know, in the dwellings, from because people had starved. And then they just slaughtered and enslaved, you know, everybody else. And so it was a great fault line between Jews and proto-Christians. And until then, proto-Christians were making a pretty good effort to be identified as Jews. But now that this had happened to Jews, well, Christians were quite motivated to say, no, that isn't us at all. No, not us. No, we're completely different. And in fact, you know, we have this old quarrel with Jews, you know, goes back to before Jesus was killed, you know, goes back to his lifetime, when he's shown fighting with the Jews, and they're always wrong and he's always right. And then they have in one gospel, the lie is just, you know, the most vile piece of fake news, in that it's stated outright that, you know, Pilate gives up, he hands Jesus over to them, which is, it's the biggest historical nonsense that there ever was. The Jews were not authorized to execute someone like this. Crucifixion was not a method anyway of the Jewish legal system. You know, they were empowered to a certain degree to run their internal affairs. The Romans weren't going to interfere, but Jesus was a political prisoner of the Romans. The Romans were extremely concerned about, you know, sources of unrest. There'd been a major, Galilee was a hotbed, and there had certainly been major rebellions. This was a very difficult place to govern, not just for the Romans, but for their predecessors. So this was a political trial. Jesus was executed by the Romans. And so to write that he was turned over to the Jews for execution is the biggest lie there ever was.
How come you change crucifix to stakes?
Okay, well, I wanted the image. I'm always going for the image. And the image is, you know, as in modern literature, tends to be the heart of the meaning.
Yeah.
This was an absolutely grisly mode of execution. You would take all day, or you would take more than a day to die in the boiling heat of the Mediterranean. They might impale your genitals. You would be crucified naked. And this entailed a special shame for people with traditional modesty, such as the Jews. And yeah, it wasn't just that they could, you know, hang you there and watch you die, but also that they would work on you. There are all kinds of things they can do to you while you're hanging there. If they're mad enough at you, and the crucifixion signals that they're really, really mad. You know, you are a major challenge to their power.
I like the way one of your
it's a stake. It's a stauros. That's the Greek word. It's the specific word for the stake that you hang people on. And as with killing a vampire, the word stake has a particular grisly meaning. So, you know, a cross is a geometric design. It doesn't have the oomph that stake does, I think.
Yeah, you can definitely visualize. That's why I said it's kind of cinematic. You do, you create the picture, a moving picture, which is, I guess, what you're trying to do. And the other interesting thing in your notes is that, totally off the topic, but I like when you explain things like 3 days, because I think it's three full days. Explain that. That's a good one.
Okay. Yeah. That's inclusive reckoning.
Yeah. I never even knew what that was.
Okay. It's pretty simple. The zero is an Arabic invention. So it's much later. It's centuries later than this. So in Roman style enumeration, or in anybody's enumeration, there is no zero in the ancient Mediterranean world. When we're calculating age, we calculate the zero age. So when you ask how young a 6 month old is, he's 6 month old. We don't say he's one. The ancients didn't have, you know, a way of saying, you know, he's not 1 year old or he's 0 years old. So they reckon age, you know, and other human measurements of time by just counting the unit from zero to one as number one. So when you're reckoning, Jesus was as killed on what would be our Friday night, he's only in the tomb for one full day. And then on what would be our Sunday morning, he's risen before it's even light out. So we would say, how long was he in the tomb? He was in the tomb one day. But see, you have two other days in the sequence that you count as full for this system of reckoning. So the important thing is that you count the zero day as a full day.
Got it.
Yeah.
Hey, here's another one that's off the wall, and it doesn't have anything to do with the translation again. So when the woman breaks the jug, the vessel, and pours, I guess it's muron, is that what it is, muron?
Yeah, it's a perfume.
Well, it's myrrh.
Yeah, it's a perfume, yeah.
Isn't that kind of overdone? It's like dumping like a quart of Chanel number 5 on somebody, because it seems like it would really permeate you because it's such a strong fragrance.
Okay, well, you know, I have to backtrack a little bit to cause this to make any sense. You don't have, in much of the Roman Empire at this stage, you don't have bathing facilities, or they're not commonly available, or traditionally they have not been available, or they're not convenient. The traditional way of bathing in the Greek world, the Romans had, you know, public baths for quite a while. Traditional way of bathing is, say, you go to the gymnasium and you're wrestling, you know, rolling around in the dirt, and you're just covered with it. You're just coated in dust, and they don't want you going home that way. So you take oil, olive oil, or so any other kind of oil will do, but olive oil was a common thing used. And you rub that on yourself, and you take a stigil and you scrape it off. And it actually works really well. So just think of, you know, the way soap works. A lot of it is some, you know, oily substance, and it sloughs off the dirt. The dirt comes off with the sort of oleaginous ingredients of the soap. That's basically how it works. But you can do it without water. And the water is the rarity. These are dry climates.
Right.
So you rub yourself with oil, take a stigil, and you scrape it all off. Or you can take a towel and rub it off. And so this was an essential part of hospitality. So somebody comes to your house, you know, and is going to dine with you, and he's been on the road, so, you know, he's filthy, he's coated with dust, you know, he's been wading through dung because there are animals all over the road, you know, and he's really dirty and he's uncomfortable. So you provide bathing facilities for him, and that means there has to be quite a bit of oil available so that he can, you know, rub himself all over, towel himself, scrape himself off, and be comfortable. And really good hospitality, you provide somebody who will, a servant or slave, you know, who will wash his feet for him. He doesn't even have to do that on his own. So, you know, the oil is there anyway, and the custom, you know, of anointing somebody is there anyway. And it's really a matter of how expensive, you know, the soap is going to be, how nice it's going to be for him. And for nice dining, for posh dining, you know, all kinds of perfumes are available. But this woman, of course, she goes absolutely all out. This is a fabulously expensive, you know, bar of soap, you know, that she offers to Jesus. And of course he snaps at one of his hosts and said, you know, you didn't even give me water. You know, she's given me this fabulously expensive oil. I dried my feet with her hair.
Yes. It's like creme de la mer. Another thing I like about your notes are that you make us understand that things that are said might not be as bad as they are. Like when Jesus says, for example, leave the dead to bury the dead. And I'm thinking, I've always thought, what a horrible thing to say. But you're explaining it, not that it wasn't as bad as it sounded.
Oh, yeah. Now that's, I'm not sure that, you know, expression is completely clear to anybody, but I think it means that it's not that you're walking away from corpses of your loved ones. It's that in the resurrection, the general resurrection, this is the apocalypse now, and people who are, you know, whisked off to heaven, you know, don't have to worry anymore about burying anybody.
Right, their corporeal body means nothing anymore.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's other ones where you just leave it be, like, why are you criticizing the speck in your neighbor's eye when there's a gigantic plank or beam in your own? And I guess you leave it alone because it says it's said pretty well.
It is said pretty well. This is the kind of beam that you would use to hold up an entire ceiling. You know, this would be like the main ceiling beam. So it's a usually exaggerated expression.
Yeah, and you can almost hear him say it sarcastically. Right. Which is good. I mean, I think that was what brought everything to life. It's an excellent expression. That's the other thing that I like, the way it's almost like, not like he's hitting someone, but like when he thinks that someone's being dumb, he's kind of going like, "You nitwit, what are you
doing?" Yes, yes. He's just wonderfully rude. I mean, everybody who, you know, like me, has ever been a classroom teacher is envious, you know, of the way that he treats his, well, literally students.
Yeah, it's like throwing the eraser at a kid's head.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's why, again, it's so good, because, well, one, like I said, it makes you laugh, which is not what you expect to be doing. Mm-hmm. But it gives a more essential reading because, like I said, it brings it to life. And, you know, I am going to read more and more of your translations, but do you try to accomplish the same thing in each one?
Well, yeah. Each one has its, you know, particular challenges, but, you know, I try to, whoever the author is, I try to crawl into that author's head and live there. You know, see through his eyes, experience his world, you know, try to understand this person as another person, you know, not as some plaster bust, but as a person like me, you know, who's had real experiences and has, you know, real joys and sorrows, real irritations. And it's the irritations that give rise to the humor often. So it's just very valuable to look into that very human, you know, segment of experience.
You know, like, I guess in conclusion, what's interesting about the way you approach this, and you kind of said it in prefatorily here, is that you're not criticizing the previous translators. You're not saying you're better or smarter than them. you're just giving us a different perspective for the most part. Would you agree with that, or would you actually think?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah, you have to appreciate, you know, the limitations that translators have had since the very beginning. And translation of the gospel started within very few years because you had these early Latin versions of them. And at that stage, people simply lacked resources for looking at the very nuanced differences that I can look at. This stuff is all online now. I don't even have to lift down the dictionaries that I have, you know, over on my shelf here. I don't have to heave them onto the desk. I can just go online and find within seconds, you know, the whole array of meanings for any particular word. It's organized that way. And when you think of, you know, how incredibly expensive books were and how rare books were and how there was just almost nothing like a reference book in existence, let alone a comprehensive dictionary, you have to admire the good job that the early translators did with what they had, you know, and you know, in the same sense, you know, how beautifully later translators handled translations with the resources that they had. You know, it's really a remarkable tradition. And, you know, I am not casting aspersions on it. I'm just doing the best I can with the resources that I have.
Yeah, I realized that when I was reading it, that I went to Google, I found out that Mark was written between 66 and 70, Matthew and Luke between 85. And how would I ever know that? When I was a kid, I'd go to the World Book, but it would take me hours to find it. And here you just have to type Gospels, go to Google, go to Wikipedia, and there are the dates that these were, and you realize, okay, these are not contemporaneous, which many people think they are. Simply, oh yeah, that's the other thing, I'll keep going on, is the names. You decided early on that you would not use the names that we're familiar with, that you would use the Greek names with the Greek pronunciation made very clear. Mm-hmm. And that changes the reader's perspective as well, a great deal.
Yeah, I'll just give you one outstanding example. James, our name James, is in Greek Iakobos. So they're just completely unlike. And I just want to do what I can to repress that anachronistic trick that all our minds do.
Exactly.
You know, if I'm reading about a James in the gospel, I'm going to think of James's, I know, you know, like James, the clerk of my Quaker meeting. And I'm going to kind of picture that. But if I have to, you know, look at the word Iakobos, and then I'm thinking of a very different person in a different culture, in a different time and place, with a completely different experience that I'm going to struggle to understand. So I have to be prepared for that struggle just a little more than if I were looking at James, you know, and picturing James, my friend. So I, with my transliterated spellings, I'm just trying to nudge people a little bit in that direction.
And it does. Oh, before we end, show the books so everyone knows. And I say that because, and it's a great cover, like all your covers are. But, you know, I have an independent bookstore, and this is on the front table. It's a great cover. And yeah, and we've been trying to sell your book, so we wouldn't be able to sell it that well without showing the cover of it. So,
well, thank you.
So, Sarah, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a pleasure reading the book. And, you know, at first I thought, oh, this is going to be really hard. And then when I got going, it was, like I said, it was like watching a really good movie or reading a really good novel. You made it so easy and so accessible, and you learned so much reading through it. So I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. It's really wonderful to hear that. And thank you for the conversation. I really enjoyed it.
So did I. So long.
So long.